Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Commerce, Georgia, and became a fighter pilot in the Air Force. On November 7th, 1967, after 53 combat missions, he was shot down over North Vietnam. He served as a POW for 5+ years and was released on March 14th, 1973. 40 years later, he's an author, leadership consultant, keynote speaker, and an inspiration to America. His name? Colonel Lee Ellis. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Grasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis, who lived in the Hanoi Hilton for 5+ years as a POW in the Vietnam War. Colonel, can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
I grew up on a small farm in Georgia in a part of the northern part of the state, northeast of Atlanta, where the land's not very rich and the soil is not very rich. But we farmed, and it was a good life. We had a lot of good food to eat. We grew a garden. We had some farm crops of the typical nature, and even cotton. But that my mother was a school teacher, and my dad worked mostly in town. My grandfather was a farmer. But that was a great experience, and probably they were just wonderful parents. It was a solid home. I had one older brother, a couple of years older. A lot of time outdoors, as any boy would enjoy. And a good, solid Christian upbringing because my parents were strong Christians, and we read the Bible at home and prayed and all that sort of thing, and it made a huge difference in my life. But it was just we were outdoors, we were in sports. That was our big dream, was to play sports a lot, and so we changed over from a local county school over to Commerce School, which is a little bit smaller town, but it was a real town, and they had a football team, so that's where we went to get our education and to play sports.
Colonel, when did you realize you wanted to be a pilot?
When I was 5 years old, we actually lived, the farm was located about halfway between Athens, where the University of Georgia is, and Commerce, where I went to high school. And Athens had a park there called Memorial Park, and in that park was an old World War II fighter-type airplane. I think it was a P-39 Air Cobra. And I climbed up on that thing at the age of 5, and that felt like home to me, and I felt like that's where I belonged. And from that point on, I just always wanted to fly. I think it was my personality. It fit me a lot, the adventure, the challenge, the idea of being in control of a machine, all those kinds of things really appealed to me. But it was just a childhood thing that happened, and from that point, I never lost sight of that dream.
How does one go about becoming a fighter pilot?
Well, you have to get commissioned as an officer in the Air Force or the Navy or the Marine Corps to be a fighter pilot. And so I went to ROTC, went through our Air Force ROTC at the University of Georgia. I probably would have gone to the Air Force Academy. I wanted to go there, but I didn't know much about it. It was still very new, and, you know, we didn't have counselors in school back then, and I just didn't know how to get there. So I didn't know how to get to the University of Georgia because it was only 10 miles away. So I went there, got in the Air Force ROTC, and I was in pre-med for a couple of years until I got some not-so-good grades in chemistry. But the good part was I got my acceptance into advanced ROTC, which meant I would be on contract to be a pilot and get commissioned. I would go to flight school. So I changed my major to history, and really my major was more like our Air Force ROTC, and I really enjoyed that a lot. I got through in 4 years, and actually my senior year, the Air Force, as part of their flight screening program, provided some flight school training at the local airport, and that turned out to be a very good experience. I got my pilot's license before I graduated from college, and went straight 3 days after I finished my last class. I got commissioned and went to flight school in Valdosta, Georgia, 53 weeks later, I had my assignment to the F-4 Phantom Fighter Bomber. The war in Southeast Asia was building up. That was August 1966. And my orders read F-4 Phantom Pipeline Southeast Asia, which meant as quick as I could get my training, combat training, and get qualified, I would be headed off to war along with the other, many of the others, most of the other people in my flight school class. So it was a great year. I enjoyed it a lot. The fighter versus the bomber or the cargo just seemed to suit me better, and I was fortunate enough to get selected for that.
You go to Vietnam in 1967. Tell us.
I went to Vietnam in the summer of 1967. At the end of June, we headed out and went to the Philippines, got some jungle survival school, and then from there to Vietnam, and I went to Da Nang Air Base, which was in the very northern part of South Vietnam. For your listeners, those who are in I Corps know where Da Nang, I guess anybody who went there knows where Da Nang is, but it was in the northern core of the South Vietnam and about probably 90 miles south of the Demilitarized Zone that separated North Vietnam, which was communist, from South Vietnam, who was our ally.
We're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis. Colonel, tell us a little bit about the first 52 missions.
Yeah, we had lost, our base had lost the mission of air-to-air combat, which was called CAP, Combat Air Patrol, flying, protecting the bombers over Hanoi when they went in up in the northern part where the MiGs were flying. And so my particular base in early July started flying just on air-to-ground missions. We called them armed reconnaissance, armed recce, which meant we flew the trails and highways, and they weren't highways like we know them. They were more dirt roads. But we flew up and down those roads and looked for trucks that were hauling stuff south and would try to knock them out before they could haul the war materials into South Vietnam. And so those most all those missions we were shot at on and hit a few times, but nothing serious. I also flew over Laos and South Vietnam in support of the Army and the Marine Corps. So those were additional missions to the 52 that I had over North Vietnam. So it was always exciting and some risk involved. It wasn't as risky as flying up around Hanoi because there were just a lot more air defenses and MiGs and surface-to-air missiles up there. It was much more intense around the northern towns and cities up there. But it was still very dangerous, and we lost a lot of pilots over the panhandle part where I was flying.
We're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis. When we come back, we'll ask him about November 7th, 1967. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Colonel Lee Ellis, the founder and president of Leadership Freedom, LLC, and Freedom Star Media. Colonel, let's go back November 7th, 1967, your 53rd mission. What happened?
Well, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when we took off. The bombing mission was the same as was most days, to recce the roads, reconnaissance, go down, fly down the roads, look for trucks and so on. But this particular day, we were working with what we called a MISTIFAC, a fast forward air controller, an F-100. And they were up there patrolling the roads looking for trucks, and they would point them out to us, and we would go destroy them. This particular day, they wanted someone to come in and knock out some anti-aircraft guns that were protecting a ferry, because we had knocked out the bridge, and they put in a ferry. So as we rolled in, and there was quite a bit of flak that day shooting at us, tracers and flak both. Flak is the airburst of these timed, they have altitude timers on the anti-aircraft artillery shells, and they will explode in proximity to the altitude where you are flying. And the tracers were periodically, they would have a tracer in there so they could actually see where the bullets were going themselves. So as we rolled in and came down the chute to release our bombs, and there were two of us in the airplane, the airplane was hit and just really kind of exploded, which is very unusual. You know, some reported after the war that it could have been even some of our bombs blew up and blew us out of the sky, but the airplane blew into several pieces. It was not flying. The stick was frozen. We had smoke in the cockpit, and it was obvious the airplane was never going to fly again, so we had to jump out quick. So I went out, and my partner went out. I was in the back seat. He was in the front seat. And fortunately, everything worked with the automatic sequence. It fired, blows the canopy off. It fires a shell. It blows the seat up through the rails, up where the canopy was, through the cockpit, top of the cockpit there. Explodes you out about 60 feet in the air, and then it separates you from the seat automatically. And as that seat separates, it automatically deploys your parachute. So all that happened in about 2.5 seconds, faster than you can really think about. You know, once I pulled the handle to initiate all that, it all happened so fast. You know, it's just very, very quick. And the next thing I know, I'm in my parachute. I check, I'm starting to follow my procedures, checking my parachute, deciding where I can land and so on. And then I noticed, obviously, I wasn't in the airplane anymore because I could now hear the gun commanders on the ground yelling and screaming commands about firing in Vietnamese. And I could hear the guns firing. I could hear bullets going by. And I was over enemy territory. Now, my life didn't flash before my eyes. I just was doing my job, following my checklist, really, following the memorized checklist I had in my head of what I needed to do. And, of course, foremost was to evade the enemy and not be captured. When you're over enemy territory, you know, and you're shot down, that's kind of your worst personal and professional nightmare. So I was just really wanting to evade. But they surrounded me very quickly when I hit the ground and captured me within less than 2 minutes. So that was... That's when I really started. I wasn't scared until that point, but once there was no longer a way that I could evade and they captured me, I knew that my life was really going to change, and I had no idea in what ways it might be going to change other than I hoped that, you know, I'd be alive and would be a good soldier and do my job as a prisoner of war.
I quote you now, "Immediately upon being captured, I knew that God had a plan for my life." Colonel Ellis, no way would you have think of God as this protective person as you just have been shot down. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, Jack, I think I'd always known God in my life. He'd always been there with me through a number of things, and I'd seen his hand on my life, and I believed his hand was on my life. So even though I couldn't see any way out of some hard times, I just believed that he had a purpose, and I've always believed that. So I think I have, you might say, a gift of faith, if there is such a thing as that. I think I have it. It's easy for me to believe, and to, and it's been reinforced by my experience with God up to that point in my life. So I fell back into that faith, and, of course, I'm totally out of control, so that's really actually a pretty easy thing to do. That God had a plan for my life, and somehow I was going to get through this, but I had to do my part. I had to do my part as my military soldier. I had to do my part as a man, as an American, but also as, you know, as a child of God, to recognize his role in my life and to cooperate with that.
You get to the Hanoi Hilton. The first 9 months, you're in a 6.5 by 7 foot cell with yourself, Captain Fisher, who got gunned down with you, and 2 Marines.
Uh-huh.
Each day you're in there for 23¾ hours. How did you survive that?
You know, one day at a time. That's all you can do when you're surviving is one day at a time. And so it was a very, very stressful time. There was obviously a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, I'd say, would be a good way to put it. They were threatening us with... trial as war criminals. They were threatening us with torture, and then they did some torture. We were very isolated. We didn't have any adjoining cell walls with any other cell, and so it was a very, very difficult time. I think having a cellmate was very important, and then over time, over the next few months, what I came to see was that Captain Fisher was a really outstanding man. A very courageous guy, a man of a strong conscience, a strong character and integrity. And That really, you know, he was senior to me, and that really set a good example. It made it a lot easier on me, there's no question about it. If I'd been totally alone, it would have been much harder. I think I could have done it, but I'm glad I didn't have to go through that trial to see. It was bad enough being there, six and a half by 7 foot cell for 9 months. You know, we didn't have much food, 6 months of pumpkin soup, very thin pumpkin soup with a piece of bread or a cup of rice, 3 months of cabbage soup, and 3 months of what we call sewer green soup. They're kind of an aquatic vegetable, kind of like lily pads, I guess. But there wasn't much solids in the soup, so we lost weight. We were kind of weak, and it took a few months, really, just to get over the shock of being there.
For 1,955 days, 5-plus years, you were in captivity. How did you pass that time?
In every way imaginable. I would think about old golf courses. I hadn't played a lot of golf. I didn't start until I was in college, and I just turned 24 and I was shot down. So I hadn't played a lot of golf, but I enjoyed it and was decent at it. So I would replay old golf courses or old, you know, where I'd played a few times and try to remember what the hole looked like and what shot I'd hit. I would remember people in my class from high school or college and think about and try to remember their names and where they sat in class. I did farming. One time I farmed for 2 months. I started with 40 acres and ended up, I owned almost the whole county. But I didn't have to pay any taxes, and I got to set my own prices, so that made it a lot easier. But it was fun, and I learned a lot through that process. I did a lot of math doing that. I memorized poems later on through passing poems through the wall and Bible verses through the wall. We would memorize those, and then I learned to speak Spanish and French and taught French in a larger room later when there was about 50 guys in a room toward the end of the war. I was able to really have classes there. But in those early years, you know, a lot of times just reflecting back on my past, what I'd done well, what I hadn't done right, when I had mistreated people, a lot of repentance there for not being the person I knew that I should have been, missing opportunities and being lazy about certain things. So a lot of stuff there to deal with, and some talking and storytelling amongst the other three guys in the cell.
We're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis, and his latest book is entitled Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. If you want to learn more, www.leadershipfreedom.com. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Colonel Lee Ellis, who served as a POW for 5-plus years and was released on March 14th, 1973. Colonel, did you ever doubt or question God?
Well, I never doubted. I always believed that we would go home someday. There were times when it was hard to imagine how long that was going to be. At first, I could only accept 6 months. Then eventually, after 6 months, I said, well, I can make it for another year. And then after a year, I said, I can make it 2 more years, but it was really 3 more years. So, you know, it was a long time, but I never gave up hope. I think most of all of us believed that someday we'd go home. Now, you know, I think being optimistic is part of a fighter pilot mentality. You have to believe that you can solve the problem, meet the challenge, overcome it, and someday come out a victor. That's just part of our mentality. And I think most people have that mentality, but that was helpful. And then having people to share with over time enabled me to make it through there. But I always believed that someday I would go home.
Did God ever talk to you?
I think I would say yes, although I can't say that I heard his voice, you know, like the voice booming from the heavens. But he made things clear to me in my mind from time to time about life there and about life in the past and life in the future. So I would say, yeah, I think so. You know, he gave me thoughts and ideas that were encouraging, and I just believed he was there with me and in the presence of my mind and my spirit, but also in my prayers, and also just so in the encouragement and connection with my teammates.
You talk a lot about leaders and courage. Mm-hmm. Robbie Reisner came up with the Reisner's Guidance, 1965. Can you talk about those points?
Sure. Well, what a great leader he was, and just the right guy for the right time. He had been a great military leader, a great aviator, a great fighter pilot, but he was also a great man and a great Christian man. And he was a senior-ranking officer, and he had been there 2 years when I got there. So he ended up being there almost 8 years. And Reisner said to me, and he said to everybody, he always passed the word and had us pass it along to others. He said, "I'm in charge, and here's what I want you to do. Be a good American, live by the code of conduct," and there's 6 articles in the code of conduct, which I lay out in my book and explain. Those were adopted after the Korean War to kind of provide a guidance, a simple guidance for prisoners of war and their relationships with their country, with the enemy, and with their fellow POWs, being faithful to your country, faithful to your POWs, and resist collaboration with the enemy. So Reisner said, "Be a good American, live by the code of conduct, resist the enemy, take torture up to the point of having permanent physical or mental damage, and then don't resist anymore. Go ahead and give in. Continue to stay mentally in the fight, so to speak, and then bounce back because they'll come back after you again." He said, "Stay in your communications, keep communicating, pray every day, and go home proud." Very simple, very powerful.
Return with honor. Another quote from you: "You have to lean into the pain of your fear to do what you know is right." Talk to us about that.
That's the best way I know how to express it, and that's kind of what we learned there, is that you were always facing situations where you had a lot of fear, but you knew what the right thing to do was, and you just have to lean into the pain of your fear and go do what you know is right. And, you know, Jack, I think that's the biggest need in our country today for leaders and everyone, as a matter of fact, but leaders especially. They get in a situation, they make a mistake, and rather than saying, "Hey, I made a mistake," which would be leaning into the pain of your fear to admit you made a mistake, "I made a mistake here, I shouldn't have done that, here's what I need to do, and I apologize," or whatever, and start doing the right thing. Instead, they start trying to cover it up, and then, you know, that doesn't work, and you know, people, eventually it usually comes out. Sometimes they get away with covering up, but generally it comes out. But you look at, you know, the coaching situation with Jim Tressel at Ohio State, or the situation at Penn State, or so many of the situations you see in the news today, and it really is when somebody has a situation, and rather than do what they know is right, they try to ignore it, step aside from it, or cover it up, and not, you know, kind of buckle up. Bryson would say, "Hitch up your boots and go do your duty." And if people would do that, we'd all be a lot better off. In the short run, yeah, it's a little scary, but in the long run, there's a real blessing and payoff.
Speaking of leaders today, one of your fellow prisoners, Senator John McCain, you were one of his buddies. The two of you came back home together.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about John McCain.
Yeah, John McCain went down 11 days before me. He went down on the 27th of October, 1967. I went down the 7th of November. So we were kind of contemporaries all the way, I guess you could say, in that regard. He's older than I am, quite a bit, several years older. But we were contemporaries in that situation. And, you know, he was probably the most seriously injured POW who came home. He had both arms broken, a leg broken. He was beaten with rifle butts, bayoneted on his capture. A lot of the first part, the broken legs and arms, broken arms and leg, came from his ejection, out-of-control ejection over Hanoi. And then some of that came from the beating and capture. But he made it through. They kind of kept him alive. They found out that his father was a four-star admiral, and I think they saw him as bargaining chip. So they kept him alive and then put some Americans with him to look after him and nursed him back to health. But he was a very tough individual, set a great example for all of us. He was offered an opportunity to come home early after about 6 months, and I think he could have, and we would have all respected him because he was so badly injured. But he said, no, I'll stay home and go home when it's my turn. And the whole plan, our plan was that we would go home sick and wounded first, and then in order of shoot, down, and capture. So first in, first out. But he said, no, I'll just wait and go when the guys that were captured, when they go home, I'll go home. And for refusing to be released as a propaganda move early in 1968, he was tortured, spent another year in solitary confinement, and just had a really rough time for it. So I really admired his courage in that situation to try to do the right thing. He certainly leaned into his pain to do the right thing, and that showed us a lot of courage. We lived in the same camp probably three different times, but we didn't see each other. We were, you know, within anywhere from 30 to 50 yards apart in different cells. But at the end of the war, when the agreements were signed, we both went to the same camp, and then they opened up the compound so we could go outside in the camp yard every day, in the prison yard, and be together with other prisoners. And so I saw John McCain every day and walked with him and talked with him. So we've known each other ever since. And he was kind enough to write the foreword to my book, Leading with Honor.
Another person that every POW praises is United States Navy Rear Admiral Jeremiah Denton. Talk mm-hmm. about Jeremiah Denton.
Yeah. Den was a great optimist, sometimes a little too optimistic for, Commander Stockdale, because he's more of a stoic. But Denton was a great leader and very courageous and did some incredible things, one of which was to blink torture he was tortured to go to a press conference with a communist reporter and do an interview, and he eventually did. But during that interview, he blinked in Morse code the word torture, and you can actually see it on the Internet today, that original video. If you just search for Denton Blinks Torture, you can see it. But he was a great communicator and a great leader and just a wonderful, another good Christian, strong Christian man who set a great example. And Denton is still alive and Reisner is still alive, and they're both 88, pushing 89 now. And they're struggling, but they're around. And Stockdale lived till he was in his 80s. So it's amazing how these guys who were in solitary confinement for over 4 years, we had contact with them a lot of the time, but they were in solitary for over 4 years and were there for 7.5 years, how those guys came back and were great leaders and carried on. And they always set a great example for us with their courage and their consistent determination to do the right thing.
We're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Colonel Lee Ellis, who was shot down on November 7th, 1967. 1,955 days later, Colonel, March 14th, 73, you come home. What was that like?
Well, you know, we'd always tried to guess what it would be like. And I don't know that it would, I guess it would somewhat like what we expected, but we didn't know what to expect. So it was wonderful, very exciting, but it was hard to get excited. It was hard to celebrate because I think we had, most of us had limited our emotions so much, we had become emotionally flat. So even though our heart leaped when that airplane broke the ground in Hanoi, the C-141, the Hanoi taxi that brought us home, at the same time, it was hard for us to hard for us to really celebrate in the way that we wanted to, just because we were so emotionally flat. But we came home, and it was very exciting. I think the best way to describe it is to be free again is just an unreal experience when you've been locked up for 5.5 years. And so every day I appreciate freedom. I appreciate the material things we have. I appreciate a roof over my head with a air-conditioned home and a heated home and a nice bed to sleep in and plenty of food and vitamins. I mean, I appreciate those things every day. The sunrise, you know, I didn't see a sunrise for several years. I didn't see a sunset for several years. So those things I really appreciate, I think, so much more than I would have before. And I, benefit in other ways from developing discipline and mental focus that I hadn't had before, and maturity. Certainly, I matured a lot. So all of those things kind of came together, and I came home, and I made a decision to continue with my flying in the Air Force, and that was, I think, the right decision for me. Had a great career in that, and I'll tell you, I've been blessed in my life being able to do what I love to do almost every day since, and that's been a wonderful experience.
If God said, Lee Ellis, let's go back to November 7th, 1967, here's what's going to happen to you. I'll give you your choice. You can get in that plane or not. Now, 40 years later, Colonel, what would you tell God?
Well, I would say I'll trust you to do what I need to do, and I'll trust that you'll be with me there. But I know that 40 years ago, I'm going to climb in that airplane because that's my duty and that's who I am. So I think you always have to be true to yourself, and I think God calls us to be true to who he's made us, and I feel like that he wouldn't put me in a situation where I couldn't be true to myself and where I couldn't grow through it. You know, he says he's always going to be with us, and I'm a witness that he was with me every step of the way. And I've lived through a lot of tough situations since I've returned, and I couldn't have done that without and keep my mind and be the person that I want to be without knowing that God is there with me.
Your latest book, once again, Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. What's the main points you try to get across in that book?
I think, first of all, doing the right thing is so, so important. And that's why leading with honor. We had leaders who led with honor. It made all the difference in the world. So to do the right thing, though, you have to know yourself and know your strengths, your struggles, and you have to be able to continue to grow to be a better person. You also have to guard your character because temptation is at every corner, and we're human beings. We are so fallible. No one's perfect. So you have to work hard to guard your character, and you have to have people around you. In every chapter, I talk about having people around you who can speak into your life, who can encourage you, who can call you back and give you positive constructive critique. And then you've got to have courage. I think that's the key right now for all of us. You can't do any of the things that you really want to do without courage because life's hard. Things are not easy. If you're a businessman, if you're a teacher, if you're a student, whatever it is, it takes courage. And that's why I keep coming back. And in fact, we have now called the Courage Challenge. And that's the lean into the pain of your fears to do what you know is right. And when you do that, good things happen. You set yourself up for the best possible outcome, even in the worst situation.
Colonel Ellis, talk to us, if you will, about our current day heroes, our soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Yeah, I'm so proud of them. I'll tell you, they have done such a fabulous job. You know, the culture they're coming out of is not the same one that I grew up in, where we had a lot of responsibility at 10 or 12, you know, taking care of animals and chopping wood and all that kind of stuff. And yet they have taken to the training quickly. They've developed a sense of responsibility and commitment that is extremely high, and I'm so proud of them. And then they've fought in a war that's gone on for more than 10 years, and they go over and come back and over and back, and I'll tell you, it's been tough, and especially tough on their families. So I really respect them and care for them and appreciate what they've done. I have been to Walter Reed and visited with some Marines that were missing arms and legs, and you know, their smiles and their willingness to lean into the pain of their situation to come back and bounce back. And recently I spoke at First Baptist Church Atlanta, Dr. Charles Stanley's church, with the real keynote. I spoke first, but the real highlight was Sergeant First Class Cedric King, who lost both legs in Afghanistan less than 12 months ago. And he could walk around, and he made it up to that stage and spoke to us there that day. And his courage and outlook was so inspiring to me. So I find them inspiring, to be honest with you.
If there's a veteran listening tonight, you know, we're losing 22 soldiers a day to suicide. If there's a soldier tonight saying, I can't go on, I think I should end it, Colonel Lee Ellis, what would you say to that person?
I would say, first of all, that's a lie from hell that you can't go on, because we know people with cancer can go on. People who lost both legs, like Sergeant King, they can go on, and we need you. We don't need you to listen to that lie that's floating through your head that you're not worth anything or it's not worth it. Listen to the truth. God made you for a purpose, and regardless of where your life has been and what you've been through, he can redeem it. And there are people around you that will reach out to you and help you and just really are looking for the opportunity to care for you and to show you how much they care and to share God's love with you. And so I would just say, don't listen to that lie. Turn to the truth and get with some people that will tell you the truth about who you are, that see your potential, and can help walk with you through this time, this situation, to the blue skies and the sunshine ahead.
Last question, Colonel. What advice would you give to our young listeners this evening?
I guess it would be about two or three pieces. Number one is choose to do the right thing. You probably know, and if you don't know, ask somebody you respect who's wise. You know, here's the situation. What do you think I ought to do? But in most cases, you know the golden rule. You know the law. You know what your parents and church and school have taught you. Do the right thing. You'll come out ahead. Secondly, know yourself. Get to know who you are as a unique person. You're special. You're unique. Get to know yourself and figure out what's the right role and place for you in this life, and don't try to be like everybody else. Be who you are. Be proud of who you are. And even though you go through some difficult times, you have some shame or guilt or tough times or anger or whatever it is, figure out a way to work your way through to the other side. And then with a commitment to be all that you can be all that God has made you, and to make a difference in this world.
Colonel Lee Ellis, thanks for your decades of service to this country. You epitomize what makes America great. Please keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Jack. Enjoy talking with you today.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.